Hi, I'm NG Jones and you're listening to the podcast Sounds About Right, audiobooks to help us understand the world, the book club that's all about learning new things and challenging our perspectives. Hi everyone, and welcome to the 15th edition of the podcast. Now, the audiobook I'm going to discuss this week is called Bad Pharma: How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. It's a book by Ben Goldacre, who is a physician, and the book is about the pharmaceutical industry, its relationship with the medical profession, and the extent to which it controls academic research into its own products. This audiobook came as a recommendation to me through my brother, who read the physical copy, and I took that recommendation on board and decided to listen to the audiobook version. And I like how this audiobook actually starts off very early with giving a disclaimer stating that it consists of no conspiracy theories or wild revelations like drug companies are withholding the secret to curing cancer or they're killing us all with vaccines. Sorry to disappoint you if you thought this was an audiobook that does that, but it does highlight how we all intuitively, from the little that we do know that something is wrong in medicine. But most of us, and this also includes doctors, can't exactly pinpoint what it is. And these issues aren't a part of public scrutiny because they're way too complicated to capture in a soundbite. Hence why they go unfixed by people we generally should expect to resolve them, such as medical professionals and politicians. Therefore, the people we should be able to trust to fix these problems have essentially failed us. But then again, there is a lack of understanding all round, and we have to understand a problem first, properly, ourselves, in order to be able to fix it. But there are assertions made in the first chapter that the book's premise is defending, and these include: drugs are tested by people who manufacture them in poorly designed trials on a hopelessly small number of unrepresentative patients and analysed using techniques that are flawed by design in such a way that it exaggerates the benefits of treatments. Unsurprisingly, these trials tend to produce results that favour the manufacturer. Also, when trials throw out results that companies don't like, they are perfectly entitled to hide them from doctors and patients, so we only ever see a distorted picture of any drug's true effects. And also, regulators see most of the trial data, but only earlier in a drug's life, and even then, they don't give this data to doctors or patients, or even other parts of the government. This distorted evidence is then communicated and applied in a distorted fashion. So in essence, we have medical professionals such as doctors, who's been in a job for over 40 years, are hearing about what works through sales reps, colleagues, or journals. But the issue is, these colleagues can be paid by these drug companies to endorse the drugs, irrespective of how effective it actually is. And this is not often disclosed. The same goes with journals and even academic papers, which everyone thinks of as objective, are actually, in most cases, written covertly. And over the years, there have been several tricks that have been introduced which have allowed researchers to overstate and exaggerate the benefits of treatments they are testing. For instance, I learned from this audiobook that academic journals who claim to be the gatekeeper of good quality research actually don't do their job well. And one of the main examples of this was during the trial period of a drug, there would be a changing of the main outcomes by the time they have finished. And the example given is essentially, if you trial 12 outcomes in a trial, but don't see improvement in any of them as a positive result, then your results are meaningless. The test for deciding if a result was statistically significant is to assume that only one outcome is being measured. However, by measuring 12, you are giving yourself 12 chances of getting a positive result, rather than one, without clearly declaring it. This therefore means that the study is biased by design and is more likely to find more positive results than they really are. This is essentially called switching the primary outcome. So before conducting a trial, they would have already stated what they are planning to measure as a possible outcome, but they would also specify a main primary outcome and distinguish real changes. However, what trials can sometimes do is report one of the, let's say, 10 other outcomes they were measuring and report that as a positive result from the trial. The problem is that even though a primary outcome should be nominated, the issue is that the primary outcome can often change from the protocol before the trial has started, and the so-called primary outcomes have been listed out, and the paper after the people who have been conducting the tests have seen their results. So he goes on to say, if the primary outcome reported in the paper is different from the primary outcome reported in the trial once it started, then that is madness, as the entire point of the primary outcome is that the primary outcome is nominated before the trial started. This is routine practice, and he goes on to give examples of when this has happened. But also beyond that, what I also found interesting was just how much of a tool marketing is when it comes to drugs. For instance, the pharmaceutical industry spends twice as much on marketing and promotion as it does on research and development, which at first glimpse comes across as extraordinary. It makes a good point that in the end of the day, people will use what they fully well know to use and the best treatment for their patients. And that when you pull away from the industry's carefully fostered belief that this marketing activity is all completely normal and stop thinking of drugs as a consumer product like clothes or cosmetics, then it suddenly realized that medicine's marketing only exists for one reason. In medicine, brand identities are irrelevant, and there is a factual objective answer to if one drug is likely to improve a patient's pain, suffering, and let's say longevity. Marketing therefore exists for no reason other than to pervert evidence-based decision-making in medicine. This is a very powerful machine, as $60 billion is spent in the US alone on medicine marketing, and this money is paid for by patients' payments into medical insurance companies or patients funded from the public purse. A quarter of the money taken by pharmaceutical companies for the drugs they sell is turned into promotional activity, which has a provable impact on doctors prescribing. This is on top of the bad evidence-based trials. And a specific passage that struck out to me within the book was how negative data goes missing and how there's a publication bias, meaning negative results of studies go unpublished, being a widespread issue throughout the whole of medicine and academia, and regulators have so far failed to do anything about it, despite decades of data showing that there's big signs of a problem. And this missing data matters because evidence is the only way that doctors or patients can possibly know if something's wrong. So by testing things as cautiously in head-to-head trials and gathering together all the evidence, then half of the data is withheld. In medicine, researchers can do as many trials as they wish and then choose which ones to publish. The repercussions of this go way beyond simply misleading doctors about the benefits and harms of interventions for patients, and way beyond trials. So every time there is a failure to publish a piece of research, real living people are exposed to unnecessary, avoidable suffering. There was also a part in the book that discussed how industry-funded trials being more likely to produce a flattering and positive result than independently funded trials being the core premise of the book and is a well-documented phenomenon in growing field of research and development. It also becomes much easier to study in recent years because the rules on declaring industry funding has become a little clearer. In 2010, three researchers from Harvard and Toronto found all the trials looking at five major classes of drugs, being antidepressants, ulcer drugs, and so on, measured two key features. Were they positive or were they funded by industry? And it was found that of 500 trials in total, 85% of the industry funded studies were positive, but only 50% of the government funded trials were. That's a significant difference. And there was another example given of how in 2007, researchers looked at every published trial that set out to explore the benefit of a statin, the cholesterol lowering drugs, which reduced the risk of having a heart attack. This study found 192 trials in total, either comparing one statin against another or comparing a statin against a different kind of treatment. The research from industry-funded trials were 20 times more likely to give results favouring the test drug. Again, that's a very big difference. And pharmacy and drugs and medicine is such a contentious issue here in the UK, of course, considering we have the National Health Service, also known as NHS, which is a publicly funded healthcare system. But also in America, I'm aware that the term big pharma is how the drug and pharmaceutical industry is making an absolute killing, apparently, with revenues of well over 1.3 trillion over the past couple of years. I think I'd be doing a disservice by calling this audiobook emotive, reason being that the author has made bold statements, but he also uses facts and case studies to back up these points. I suppose the only caveat is that this book was published in 2012, so it's been 10 years. So whether there has been any significant changes within the industry since then, or things are still the same, who knows? But most certainly, up until the point this book was published, there was a huge issue regarding the pharmaceutical industry. Thank you so much for getting to the end of this podcast and listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please do get in touch with me with your audiobook recommendations and subscribe wherever you can so you'll be in the loop on the next episode. I'll see you then.